This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. I'm Samantha Lam, the host of the channel, and today we're talking to Nicholas Breifogel, David Moon, and Alexandra Bekasova about their new collected volume, Place and Nature, Essays in Russian Environmental History. So, could you all tell us a little bit about yourselves? Maybe Nick, we'll start with you.
Sure. Thanks for having us, Samantha. I'm Nick Breifogel. I'm an associate professor of history at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. And I've been working on for several years a kind of environmental history of Lake Baikal. And I've also produced several other edited volumes dealing with Russian and Soviet environmental history.
Okay. David, would you like to say a couple words about yourself?
Yeah, for quite a long time now, I've been working on Russian, Eurasian, transnational environmental history. My particular interest has been in the steppe, in grasslands. And so this project brought me to different regions, new regions of Eurasia. I have posts at the University of York in England, an honorary post at University College London, and for a couple of years recently, I was a visiting professor at Nazarbayev University in northern Kazakhstan.
Okay, thank you. Alexandra, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Alexandra Bekasova. I'm associate professor at the High School of Economics, St. Petersburg campus, and teaching on bachelor's and master programs. And I'm happy to be the member of the Laboratory for Environmental and Technological History with strong team of scholars who are doing environmental and technological history. And myself, I'm working on the history of mobility, technology, and environment.
Okay, thank you. So let's talk about what inspired this collection. Nick, would you like to tell us?
I'd be happy to. And I guess I would say that in many respects, David gets the lion's share of the credit for inspiring this project. And it's probably good you sent the question my way, because I feel he would likely be too modest to take the applause that he richly deserves for this. But this is a book that developed out of a 3-year grant from the Leverhulme Trust entitled "Exploring Russia's Environmental History and Natural Resources." It was an international network grant from the Leverhulme Trust, and the project, in many respects, was designed really to do three things. One was to bring together a sort of international collaborative, multidisciplinary team of scholars from Russia, from the United Kingdom, and from the United States, both faculty and graduate students together to meet, to research, to talk, and to learn about Russian environmental history, and then in many respects, hopefully, to offer a kind of a new, perhaps fuller understanding of Russian and Soviet environmental history, to try to place the case of Russia into a global context, and to think about the ways in which we could offer certain types of historical perspective on contemporary environmental issues in Russia and the former Soviet space. So the grant was designed to bring together these scholars to explore these questions of environmental history, and to do so in a way that was perhaps a little bit different, to bring in a kind of new approaches methodologically. And what I mean by that was the grant and this whole project was focused particularly on bringing scholars out into the field, placing them into the environments, into the nature that they were studying, not simply to do the usual thing, which is to kind of take us to archives or libraries, to have us meet in windowless rooms, to have conferences and that sort of thing, but actually to get out into the world itself, to embed ourselves into natural environments where we could, you know, smell, taste, feel, explore, understand these places on a very kind of physical and visceral level, and also to meet with local people, local inhabitants of these regions, and local scholars, and in order to really be able to enhance what we could bring to the table when we wrote about Russian environmental history, so we weren't just basing what we write on dusty documents somewhere, but rather from real lived experience in these places. The original project focused particularly on three regions. The grant did on the Solovetsky Islands in the Northwest, Chernobyl and the exclusion zone, and then Lake Baikal out in Siberia. And this book is one of the outcomes of this larger project with this larger vision. And of course, it's the kind of book that with its geographic diversity and its disciplinary types of diversity, simply wouldn't be possible for a single individual to write. And so it's a marvelous compilation of the expertise of a variety of scholars from around the world.
So what did you learn from locating your research in the places you study, and what unique perspectives does this bring to your topic? Nick, we'll start with you.
I think what I really brought to this whole project was my experience and knowledge of Lake Baikal in particular. Baikal is a place of world importance and world interest. It's certainly one of the most interesting and dare I say, kind of unique environmental locations in Russia and the kind of Soviet Union, and this was an area that I think the team was particularly interested in exploring, and I think I also brought to this project a larger focus on what we might call water history, and exploring the human water relationship over time.
Okay. David, what about you? What do you think locating your research in places brought to your studies here?
Right. I think we learned a lot from sharing our expertise and experience. And so one of the things I learned from is meeting people in the locations, visit, exploring them, as Nick has just explained, but also exploring different locations, meeting different people. I'd not previously been to Lake Baikal or indeed Siberia, so I learned a lot from that trip, from exploring it, from the people we met. I hate to single out chapters from the book because we're very fortunate to have a whole series of excellent chapters by fine scholars. But if I can just mention one, a chapter on Lake Baikal by Arkady and Tatiana Kalichman. They're scientists, geographers based in Irkutsk. They joined our trip to Baikal and they were like our expert guides. Their chapter in the book draws on their deep knowledge and involved in the movement to protect and conserve Lake Baikal, going back to the late Soviet period, and both in our conversations on our trip and subsequently, and in their essay, their book, they bring not just their scientific knowledge, but also their passion for the environment. And they shared that with us. And that was something I very much got out of the trip, out of the project, out of the book. I could carry on talk about different chapters, but I think I'll just mention that as the example.
Okay. Alexandra, what about you? What unique perspective did you get from visiting the places you researched?
I agree with my colleagues, yeah, with Nick and David. And that is exactly important points for me as well. But I would like to stress one point more. On that way, what we were doing together for several years, we were on the way. So we are between places, yeah? And we were working together, exchanging our experiences, yeah, and skills, and sharing ideas with each other. And local people, inhabitants of places, and all that experience of being on the way, yeah, being in between, teamwork, yeah, that is exciting experience for me, yeah, during the project.
Okay. So the main thesis of this book is how human engagement and input transforms wider, undifferentiated spaces of the natural world into culturally meaningful and technologically differentiated places. Can you explain to our listeners the difference between space and place in this context? Maybe David, you would like to try?
Yes, both Nick and Alexandra have spoken about how we shared our experiences of these places, of our research, and brought different perspectives, different ideas. And during these, we were looking for theoretical underpinnings to what we were doing. And I look back to the seminal work of human geographer Li Fu Tuan, writing back in the 1970s. And for Tuan, and I think also for me, and perhaps more generally for the group, space is an abstract, space is freedom. And I understood Tuan to mean that these are areas which particular people have no connections with, no personal experiences of, haven't invested time and energy in. Perhaps they're just areas they've looked at on maps, perhaps have read about, or perhaps looked on Google Earth. Places have acquired particular meaning for particular people who've got to know them, had experiences of them, drawn sustenance from culturally and physically. So they've become sort of embodied in these places and perhaps the other way around as well. In the context of our book and the project that emerged from it, I'd not previously been to any of the locations we visited because my expertise is on other parts of Russia. So to me, all the places we visited, Solovki, Chernobyl, Baikal, we also went to the Northern Urals region, were just areas I'd read about, I knew about them, but I've now visited them, spent time there, explored them, got to know people who've lived and worked there. We also gained close experience from the forms of transport we used in our expeditions. Alexandra spoke briefly about this idea of being between places. So we walked on Solovki, we walked on the shores of Lake Baikal, explored former industrial regions of the Urals on foot. We sailed in boats on and swam in Lake Baikal. We rode boats in the canals on Solovki. So we got close personal experience of them. So we turned these spaces into places.
And how do differing definitions of nature affect the ideas you explore in the book?
One thing that emerged from our discussions is comparing, and when we're writing up the book, is comparing Tuan's distinction of space and place with the concept of environing, which has been developed and put forward by Sverker Solin and Paul Ward, which we also discussed in the introduction to the book. They argue that nature is perhaps something out there, but nature becomes environment as a consequence of human influence. So to take examples from our book, and this is explored in detail by Alexei Trykovsky and Yulia Lajus in their chapter, which opens part one of the book, the nature of Solov Key, the Solovetsky Islands, was, to use Sorlene and Ward's term, environed by the monks who lived there for centuries, exploited its resources and gave cultural meaning to the islands, by the gulag laborers who were there in the interwar years, by conservationists who now protect the environment and its natural and current cultural heritage. So we brought these concepts of space and place and environing and located them in particular places which are explored in our book.
Okay. That sounds really interesting. So many of your chapters deal with water histories. Nick, could you tell our listeners what you mean by this term and why water histories are interesting to scholars?
In some respects, you know, water history is as simple as, it's a branch of the broader field of environmental history, but is really looking at humanity's relationship with water, with waterways, and with aquatic environments and ecologies over time. And this matters because ultimately, you know, water has defined every aspect of human life that we can imagine. We are ultimately primarily made up of water, about 60% on average of our bodies, much of the Earth's surface. In fact, water is integral to life everywhere. So that water defines human life from the sort of molecular, biological, and ecological to the cultural, religious, economic, political, everywhere you look. So in some respects, the history of humans is actually also the history of water, and vice versa. Because of the fact that humans cannot survive without water in so many different ways, for drinking, for food, and so many other important matters, the history of water is one that allows for immediate comparison across time and across place. And is tremendously important. And it can be a whole variety of different areas from irrigation and agriculture, for example. Most of our water today goes into agriculture production, drinking water, water pollution, the religious uses and kind of implications of water, droughts and floods, bathing, cleanliness, leisure, beauty. Water is an energy source, whether from water wheels or to hydroelectricity. Water is transport. So there's a whole variety of different types of topics that this area takes on. I think it's really an important area to study because of the ways in which it intersects with just about every aspect of human life. And because, of course, today we live in a world that in a variety of places is struggling with a series of water crises, whether too much water, too little, or water that is of a quality that we can't use, often because of pollution and that sort of thing. Had a lot in the news recently about droughts in the west of the United States, plastic pollution in our oceans, and the list goes on. So the studying of water history is tremendously important for contemporary issues as well.
So within the context of this book, were there any water histories that struck you as particularly interesting?
Yeah, I mean, the book is great in terms of doing water history. It's funny, we didn't set out to write a kind of water history type of book. This wasn't the goal here, but to a certain degree, the places we ended up, like the Solovetsky Islands, obviously in the White Sea, and then Lake Baikal, you know, two extraordinarily interesting and important kind of places in nature and environmental locations for study. They are both ones that have immediate kind of water implications. Obviously there's several chapters in the book that deal with Lake Baikal, which is close to my heart, but let me just highlight a couple of others. We have a great chapter by Andy Bruno on Lake Imandra and a kind of long history of this lake and the human relationship to the lake.
Who may not know, could you explain where that lake is? Baikal, I think most people are familiar with, but Lake Imandra, our listeners may not recognize.
Absolutely. Very happy to. It's up kind of in the kind of northern Kola kind of Karelia region, very close up, just kind of south, just south of Murmansk kind of area. You know, this is something that Andy Bruner took on in his marvelous book on the kind of environmental history of this region. But the lake itself is particularly interesting and important for the ways in which it shifts over time from a place of kind of food importance and religious importance and transport importance for the native Sami people to a place that became tremendously polluted because of the ways in which Soviet industry used it as a kind of dumping ground for waste from mining and industrial activities, and then the ways in which the lake became integrated into energy production in the region, both through a hydroelectric dam and through the use of the water of Lake Imandra in a nuclear facility. And Bruner really takes us through the transformation of the human relationship with this lake across the longue durée, and ends with us realizing the ways in which, well, we're never going to go back to the world that there was before, but now the lake now is in some ways a new type of ecosystem and a new type of kind of hydrological reality as a result of all of these different types of human interventions over the course of time. The other chapter I might highlight is one about St. Petersburg by Robert Dale. He explores in ways that I think are really interesting a kind of comparison of the 1824 flood of St. Petersburg and the 1924 flood of St. Petersburg or Leningrad, I should say, and the different ways in which people at the time responded to and tried to kind of save themselves from these floods. I mean, St. Petersburg has from its very beginning been defined by the water that was around it in the Neva River, but also just the kind of wetlands that really was St. Petersburg at its founding. And then, you know, these consistent and ongoing floods that have in some ways plagued the city, these two being particularly important moments in that regard. And so he tells the story and then compares the experiences of these two floods. And it's a really interesting and exciting chapter.
Can I just come in quickly here, Samantha? One of the things we aim to do in the book was to turn attention to areas which reader specialists may not automatically associate with Russian Soviet environmental history. So rather than going over, again, topics that have been researched before in a lot of depth, we wanted to bring in new areas. And so water history was one of those. You wouldn't necessarily think a book on Russian Soviet environmental history with lots about water. But of course, in the way Nick's explained, it was central not just to our project, but it's central, I think, to Russian, Soviet, and indeed global environmental history. So turning attention to things that were new. And this is true of many of the chapters in the book, as well as the ones we've mentioned so far.
Well, certainly when I talk to people about Central Asia, water is always key.
Yes, of course, yeah.
So you also talk about mobility histories in this book. Alexandra, would you like to explain this term to our listeners and how that dovetails with environmental histories?
Yes, thank you. Studies of movement, yeah, in geographical space, that is the focal point of our collection. And spatial and mobility turns, which happened in social sciences and humanities recently, they were very much important for our approach of space, mobility, technologies of movement, yeah, and environment. And that is exactly underlying themes, yeah, in our collection. The circulation of people, information, and things across huge space of the Russian Empire transformed populations and landscapes, restructured identities, created enduring legacies. As pilgrims, migrants, travelers, tourists moved, they encountered various environments which required different techniques and cultures to engage with natural world. And when we are focusing on that practices of movement and engaging with different kinds of environment, that is also about producing different meanings on the way. And exploration of mobility practices to better understand travelers' behaviors, perceptions, motivations, that is an exciting thing dealing with mobility histories, and focusing in that context of environmental and technological history. And our contribution to the collection we co-authored with Ekaterina Kalimeneva is exactly focused on that theme. And we tried to look at how places along the route of Trans-Siberian Railway were presented in the guidebooks as landscapes of transportation, to that growing numbers of travelers, who made their journey in the final decades of Imperial Russia, the railroad itself, and the railroad infrastructure was presented as a symbol of progress, something huge and impressive. Other regions, with lakes, and forests, they were presented as wild places. And through that, the railway journey, itself made distant areas, and landscapes, like the region of Lake Baikal, accessible to many people, and through the opportunities which they can enjoy sitting in the railway compartments and admires panoramas. That is the process of how those panoramas became kind of commodities, exactly through that process of railway journey.
So who was the audience for these guidebooks? Were they meant for Russians? Were they meant for foreign travelers? Were they meant for wealthy people or regular travelers?
There were different kinds of guidebooks, and they were addressed to different kinds of audiences. Those which were published on Russian language, they were much more addressed to the Russian-educated reading public. But there were another publications. They were extremely small, if we're comparing to that with the photographs, or drawings. And they were addressed to those with which can't afford buying such kind of books. So there are different kinds of audiences in Imperial Russia as well. But there were a number of publications that were published in main European languages. They were addressed for those who are interested to travel to Russia and cross that huge imperial space and reach maybe Japan or China. Those published in French, English, German languages, they were addressed for different audience.
And did the different guidebooks have different depictions of nature? Did Russian guidebooks treat nature and the wild areas differently than guidebooks aimed at Europeans?
I should say that all of them, yeah, they were presented natural environment in the same way, yeah, and that is about fascinating, yeah, technological achievements and innovations, yeah, like bridges, yeah, that huge infrastructures, yeah, and wild nature of Siberia, yeah. So that is exactly the point for all kinds of guidebooks that were published at that time for several decades.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Nick, I believe you also have a chapter that deals with migration history when you talk a little bit about the monks and other people that move into the islands of Slovaki.
Yeah, I contribute. There are two chapters in the book that deal with Solovki. You know, the first is a really marvelous chapter that David referred to earlier by Yuli Elias and Alexei Krakowski, which is a really marvelous kind of historical examination of the ways in which this island, in some respects, turned from nature to environment, using that a concept of environing. And I added a chapter that was much more a kind of personal reflection on my experiences traveling there. The kind of core part, or this is not the core part, but the central part of the book has four different kinds of travel essays that relate the experiences of our team as they went to a variety of different locations, you know, from Solovki to Lake Baikal to the Ural Mountains, and these travel essays were designed to be a little bit different, to really kind of bring out the kind of personal experience of being an environmental historian, but one who is experiencing these places, and in my case, experiencing Solovki for the first time. That's a place I had not been before joining this group, and. The whole question of migration or mobility or getting there was something that was of real interest to me while I was spending time on the islands. The story of these islands is one in which there really wasn't human habitation initially, other than fishermen who would go out seasonally and for short periods of time to kind of fish the waters and then head back home. The shift to kind of human habitation happens as a result of two monks in search of kind of solitude and escape from human life. They want to get away from all the other people so that they could praise God and contemplate God and be kind of away from any other kinds of worldly distractions. And in a place that would really test them physically and show their kind of spiritual mettle, they head off and paddle their way across from the mainland to the Solovetsky Islands. And I'd read this story before, and I'd even taught it in classes. But to be honest, making the trip out there really helped me to appreciate just. I suppose it's the courage or the dedication of these monks that they set off into seas that can be extraordinarily rough and difficult, and off to a place that they couldn't see, that they hadn't been before. People told them that it existed, but they couldn't be 100% sure, and that they would head off to this particular place, just the two of them, with no resources, no backup, no anything, was something that was really quite remarkable, just from just my own personal experience, because I went out on the ferry on a very calm day, and it was a lovely, beautiful ride, and then actually had to leave early from Salavki, a day early, because the storms were so intense that they were just about to shut down the ferry, and I had to catch a flight back and all these sorts of things. But to suddenly realize just how rough the seas could be was really something quite extraordinary to me. And but then, you know, the stories of these monks, they went out and they're renowned as ascetics and hermits, really spread, and they start to attract other people who came to join them to be a part of their religious community. I don't think the monks were particularly happy to have others arrive, but they came nonetheless. And then this was the foundation of the really remarkable monastery that is there to this day. And for me, the experience of Salavki was also amazing from a mobility perspective, in the sense that, you know, initially it was the cold and distance and really harsh setting that drew these monks and religious figures out to the area, and then in the 20th century, Salavki became one of the founding places of the Gulag system. And curiously enough, once again, the distance, the cold, the forbidding and really difficult kind of climate became something that drew people out. But in this case, not voluntarily, that they were forced to come out to the area. And so we see a similar sort of human relationship to nature in terms of the ways in which the specific sort of temperatures and climate and distance of Salavki brought people out, but for totally different reasons from, you know, the 14th and 15th and 16th centuries to the 20th. And it's a remarkable place. I could go on about the canals, which they built there for transport, but I'll leave that for the moment. That was also another amazing part of the story of mobility there.
That's funny, because it's very similar to the history of Kirov-Vyatka. You know, our climate makes us a place where they have been dumping political prisoners for centuries. You know, people like Saltykov, Shchedrin, Alexander Herzen were exiled to Vyatka. Herzen found Vyatka so terribly boring that he claimed it forced him to have an affair with a married woman. And of course, in the 20th century, we also had our own gulag, Vyatlag, in the north of the region. So it's interesting to see how these climates affect. But we also got some advantages. Vyatka didn't have much in the way of serfdom. They developed strong zemstvos as a result. So there's a history of self-determination, self-rule, and krajovidenia, an understanding of ourselves as a distinct and separate region that really derives from climate too. So that's really interesting.
Well, and that is, just to follow up there, that is one of the things that I think we found really interesting about this project is taking on a series of really big, perhaps even global questions of environmental history, but then embedding them into the specifics of each locality that we went to, and realizing the ways in which the geology, the hydrology, the climate of specific regions, and then the human interactions with those were really determinative of creating the types of societies and the types of cultures and the types of human experiences that existed in each of these places.
Yeah, we built mobility into the structure of the book. And so in the first section, we take our readers around northwestern Russia, the European North, as well as the chapters we've mentioned. Alan Rowe takes us into the Taiga Forest of Karelia and Arkhangelsk Oblast. Then in the final part of the book, we travel right across Siberia with Alexandra Mikhasov and Yekaterina Kalimenova's chapter. And we end up in the Soviet and the Russian Far East with Mark Sokolsky's essay on hunting civil society and wildlife conservation on the Pacific coast. So our readers will also get some sense of the space and mobility from the structure of the book and the chapters.
Cool. So let's talk about this idea of Russian environmentalism, because the words Russia, Soviet Union, and environment tend to conjure up images of gargantuan Stalinist schemes to conquer nature by ruthlessly exploiting resources, building large industrial cities from scratch that polluted their surroundings and the inhabitants, damming rivers, destroying ecosystems, and of course, ecological disasters. But there were also movements to conserve and protect nature that date all the way back to the Tsarist era. With Nick, last time we did an interview, we talked briefly about these ideas. But I was wondering, David, if you would care to inform our listeners of what sort of environmental protection schemes and movements developed in Russia and the USSR, and how this information should change our perception of these polities.
Yes, this is an important point. Before I do so, just a quick comment on your remarks about gargantuan schemes and transformation and pollution of nature. These are all well documented, completely undeniable, and there's been a great deal of research on the environmental degradation of these lands as part of a global story of this. In our book, we have an important essay by Yelena Kochetkova that looks at industrial development and institutional debates about Lake Baikal and how they gradually moved towards protecting the environment rather than just polluting it. But this is a long, complex story. On the experience of nature protection, this isn't something I think that immediately springs to mind when people think of words Russia, Soviet Union, environmental history. But there's a legacy of nature protection for scientific reasons going back to the late 19th century. And scientists argued of the need to protect what they believed to be samples of untouched nature. They thought there were areas of nature which had not been affected by human impact. Subsequent research in ecology, we know this isn't really the case. But they wanted to protect them as baselines, as models through which to carry out research into human impact on the environment, and models to draw on for ways to think of more, devise more sustainable ways of using the land. One of the scientists who pioneered this idea was Vasily Dokuchaev in the 1890s in his research on steppe environments. This was also the scientific underpinning for a network of nature reserves, strict nature reserves called Zapovedniki, which developed all around the Soviet Union in all the different environmental regions. In a few moments, Nick will speak a bit about Balguzin on Lake Baikal, which we visited, which was the first of these state nature reserves. But it wasn't the first reserve in the Russian Empire that was based on a principle of protecting an area that was believed to be virgin nature. And this is in the steppe of southern Ukraine, founded by a private landowner, Friedrich Falzfein, in the 1880s. He set aside an area of unplowed steppe on his estate, just to the north of the Crimean Peninsula, to protect it for scientific research, because he saw that all the land was being ploughed up, all the steppe was being ploughed up. The native wildlife, the wild horses, the saiga had all disappeared. So he wanted to preserve a sample, and then he started collecting wild ungulates and putting them on his land. He was ennobled by Tsar Nicholas II for his services to nature conservation. I think something that's not widely known. One of the pioneers of Russian environmental history in the West globally was Douglas Wiener, who wrote two really impressive books, which are also a history of science as well as environmental history, where he explores these ideas of nature protection, nature conservation, a scientific underpinning, the application of these in establishing this system of nature reserves around the Soviet Union, and also the struggles the scientists engaged with when they were coming up against an official ideology that was based on building socialism, industrialization, exploiting nature, transforming nature, and the way the scientists managed to carve out a space for themselves, to carve out a space for nature protection, to the extent where they would present their work as nature conservation as part of socialist construction. He calls this protective coloration, the way they presented their ideas, as fitting with the governing ideology. But they were able to persist. The network of nature reserves, which we visited one or two during our trips, and many of us have visited many others in the course of our researches, they persisted throughout Soviet times. They got cut back at various times. They were interfered with, but they did continue. So this is, I think, an important story, which is known through Douglas Wiener's work and other work by, for example, Felix Stillmark. But I think this deserves emphasis. Then in the 1980s, with the advent of perestroika, glasnost, then we saw the emergence of environmentalist movements, how we would understand them internationally in the Soviet Union, in particular provoked by the Chernobyl explosion, but also issues such as the pollution of Lake Baikal. And I've spoken about the Kalikman's involvement in these movements, which they speak about in their chapter in our book. Yeah, one thing, we've mentioned Chernobyl a couple of times in this interview. We actually published separately on Chernobyl, so we don't feature Chernobyl in this particular book, but we do address these issues.
Yeah, I was starting to wonder if I had really skipped a chapter or something.
No, the chapter, the Chernobyl is elsewhere. You can, I won't talk about it because listeners who are interested can just Google my name, Chernobyl, and they'll find something. They'll find some of the things we wrote.
Okay. So, Nick, you wrote on Barguzin Zapovednik. Would you like to tell us a little bit about, you know, what it is, why this nature reserve is particularly important, and what you've learned about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be happy to. If you don't mind, I'd love to highlight just two other. We have several chapters that deal with the question of nature protection, and I just wanted to. I'll speak about Barguzin because, you know, it's very close to my heart, and I'm very happy to do that. I also just wanted to highlight two other chapters that we've talked a little bit less about so far in the interview, that also focus on these questions. One is the chapter by Mark Sokolsky that looks at the Russian Far East in the late 19th and early parts of the 20th century, particularly looking at the ways in which we see the early development of nature protection movements focused in around kind of elite hunting societies who are trying to protect their game from extirpation. And he tells a marvelous and really interesting story about the ways in which nature conservation there gets caught up in, particularly in racial issues around colonial development, and how many of these hunting societies blamed Chinese in particular, but also Korean migrants for the demise of species, so that the imposition of colonial power and nature protection went in some respects hand in glove there in ways that it might be surprising to some readers. The other chapter I just want to highlight is actually, so if Mark was in the late 19th, early part of the 20th century, we have another really marvelous chapter by Alan Rowe, which looks at the kind of the origins of the development of a national park in Karelia, the Vodol Ozera National Park. And Alan, as anybody knows from his book on the history of national parks in the Soviet Union, has done an incredible amount of research and spent a great deal of time in these areas. And he tells a really remarkable story of the very personal venture and experience of a single individual from Ukraine to help develop this this national park. And the parks were, you know, David described the Zapovedniki as one of the, ultimately one of the great contributions to conservation that Russia and the Soviet Union has made. The national parks were a slightly different type of model, one that came out of the United States with the idea of parks being places where you could where you would protect nature, but you would also allow for human tourism and human experience there. And Alan Rowe's chapter in the book really does an amazing job of exploring those kinds of questions. In between those two bookends, I have a chapter that explores the kind of history of the origin and beginnings of the Barguzin Zapovednik. The Barguzin Zapovednik was created or came into being in 1916, just months before the end of the Tsarist era. It was the first, as David said, state-sponsored nature protection kind of or Zapovednik in Russian history, and it has continued to this day and remains one of the, for me, one of the great opportunities of this whole project was the opportunity to go into the Zapovednik and spend a few days there with the group hiking through the extraordinary forest there, spending time in the little village of Davsha, meeting the people who are looking after the Zapovednik today. And it's important because the Zapovednik is important because of its longevity, because it was tremendously successful ultimately, and because in many respects it became a kind of model for the future development of Zapovedniks in the Soviet Union. And what I found most interesting in telling this story of its origins in 1916 was the ways in which it wasn't just that humans came in and decided they wanted to protect nature, but that the geological, the hydrological, the various species that lived in this region had not always conscious, obviously, but had real kind of influence on the process of where they set up this Zapovednik, how big it was going to be, what the borders were going to be, and this sort of thing. And in a sense, the Barguzin Zapovednik is up on the northeast side of Lake Baikal. It's pretty distant from many things, and certainly was in 1916. But a great deal of the reason for choosing this location had to do with the desire to protect the local sable population. Sables were a tremendously important economic kind of commodity. They had been disappearing quite rapidly over time throughout all of Siberia. There was a particular type of sable with a very, very highly desired type of fur in terms of color and quality. And so part of the reason to protect this region was to protect the sable. So set aside land in this part of Baikal in order to try to protect the sable and to try to protect this kind of commodity. The other thing that I found really interesting about this story, just to highlight quickly, is, you know, when you set up the question, you talked about sort of the difference between, you know, the heavy-handed and almost kind of painful interventions of you know, gigantic kinds of environmental buildings and interventions, and then compared to the sort of nature conservation. One of the things that becomes clear in the history of Barguzin is the ways in which nature protection was itself also a human intervention into nature, in the sense that, you know, on the one hand, many of the native peoples of that region, the Evenks, were pushed out of their lands as a result of all of this. And at the same time, as soon as they start to set aside this region for protection, then suddenly there's a change in the ecosystems, in the sense that no longer are there humans hunting around, and instead you start to see a kind of vibrant growth of multiple different types of species that probably wouldn't have grown up otherwise. The development of integrated types of ecosystems in this region as a result of kind of humans standing back. So the decision not to intervene in or to protect a region actually has its own environmental and ecological kinds of outcomes.
Cool. So did you enjoy your trip there?
Me? Yes, tremendously. I think I enjoyed every trip that we did. You know, the trip to Barguzin in particular was really remarkable to be able to, this is part of the, I think, the methodological contribution of the volume, is that it was one thing for me to read about the formation of this nature preserve, to read about its activities over the decades, to look at it on a map, to even look at it on Google Earth, but to actually be there, to be able to walk up and down the river areas, to actually see what these rivers really looked like and felt like, ones that I'd been staring at a map, to be able to hike up into the forest to get a really good feel of what the people in the 19th century were really actually talking about when they talked about the types of trees that were there and the strands and why they chose one river over another as the border for the Zapovednik and this sort of thing. And I mean, it's extraordinarily beautiful location I found. So just on a visceral level, I became very close to my heart to be able to see, I mean, just the trees and the forests. Remarkable place. And we went in a year, the environment and nature are never far away in the sense that we went in a year where there was tremendous forest fires in Siberia and in the Baikal area. So that was smoke everywhere while we were there. So a lot of the kind of what you might see in the distance was actually obscured as a result of all this. And it was sort of a reminder of the ways in which climate matters in terms of setting off these fires. It was also a year where the waters of Lake Baikal were as warm as I've certainly ever experienced. And so usually it's a pretty chilly swim, the kind that sort of takes your breath away. But the year that we were there swimming around just outside Barguzin was extraordinarily warm and really pleasurable for a change. So, yeah, it was good fun. Good fun for sure, as well as being extraordinarily important for my own kind of intellectual development.
Yeah, I find it really does make a difference when you can see in person the things you research. I mean, I've lived in my research area for almost 10 years now, and I like taking day trips out into the countryside to see the different villages, and even now, how remote some of them are, how poorly connected to infrastructure, and trying to imagine, based on my own research, what the life must have been like in the 1930s, how difficult administration and stuff would have been. So yeah, I think it's a really important thing for people to do, to see them in real life. So our very last question is, what do you want listeners and readers to take away from the collection? Alexandra, why don't we start with you? We haven't heard from you in a while.
I should say that engagement, and positive emotions, impulses, when we are thinking about place-based research conducted in a strong international interdisciplinary team, listening and opening the book, and looking it through, and to the photos, and to the different perspectives, maybe that kind of things like emotions, engagement, that is most important things. Thank you.
Yeah, I did notice your book has a lot of photographs for a historical book, and a lot of color photographs. So that was an interesting and welcome change. David, would you like to tell us what you would like our listeners to learn?
Before I do so, I should acknowledge the Levy Hume Trust, which provided funding for us to have colour photographs. So we were very pleased. And also Whitehorse Press has done a wonderful job in producing and presenting the book. I've got three quick points on what I hope readers, listeners will take away. One, Russian Soviet environmental history, more than just destruction, transformation of nature. This is an important part of this, but this part of the world is part of a more complex, multifaceted, global story of human engagement with the environment. The second point, there are many fascinating, important regions of Russia, of Eurasia, which have fascinating environmental histories that merit further research, further investigation. And thirdly, a point we keep coming back to, which Alexandra's just spoken about, I think the value of drawing on personal experiences to help us understand topics we're researching and help us explain. A number of authors are doing this. Kate Brown does this in her work on Chernobyl, Plutopia, on atomic cities. Bathsheba DeMuth, a recent book, Floating Coasts, on the Bering Straits region. Both these authors draw on their personal experience. in our book. Some of our authors do this implicitly in the way they present the depth of their understanding. Others, in particular the section of photographic essays we have in the middle of the book, do this explicitly, where we draw on our personal engagement, personal experiences of the places we explored.
Okay. And Nick, what would you like our listeners to take away?
I have the sense that David and Alexandra have covered much of what I'd say, but let me just underscore or kind of support what they said. I mean, I think that what I hope people will take away is first the real value and importance of international kind of collaborative interdisciplinary type of work. Historians are traditionally, you know, solitary types of souls, and you know, for me, the extraordinary benefit that there is in people working together and learning from each other. The amount that I learned from David, from Alexandra, from so many of the other scholars on our in our community, in our network, is almost immeasurable to me. I was really transformed as a historian in that process, and so I'm really thankful for that. And I hope that this book can be a model and a reminder to people of the importance of that kind of collaborative teamwork in things like history, which, as I say, are so often individual types of affairs. I'd also highlight for the readers the importance of the personal experience for the depth of understanding, as David mentioned, but also because, you know, we as authors in the writing of history so often try to write ourselves out of the story. We try to write from a sort of omniscient kind of narrator perspective, as if we're really not there and our own sort of experiences and approaches are supposed to be, you know, hidden or behind the scenes, are not supposed to come onto the page directly. I mean, obviously, we all bring those things to everything we write. And so I like our approaches in this book in the way in which we are very upfront and very clear about the ways in which our personal experiences with these places have really defined how we're going to write about them. What are the stories we're going to tell? How we're going to approach those stories? And the connections that we feel to these places, because one can't help but feel some kind of a connection to a place, whether it's a close connection or a sense of you know, disgust or dislike for a particular place. But one feels these kinds of one has strong feelings in that way about the places one comes to, and to bring those out into the foreground of how we write strikes me as very very important. And of course, you know, to write environmental history, it's essential. And really, I mean, as you said, Samantha, not just environmental history, but really any kind of history, to know the places, to spend time in the places you've been, even if you are living decades or centuries after the time period you're talking about. So it's not the same place anymore. But to be there and to experience it makes a big difference about in terms of how we produce these things. And then I hope that readers will realize the extraordinary value of studying Russian and Soviet environmental history, particularly from a global comparative perspective. I'm hopeful that people who study the environmental history of other parts of the world or other time periods will come to this book to realize the degree that there's a lot to be learned from the remarkable kind of diversity of nature and environment that existed and continues to exist in Russia and the Soviet Union.
Well, thank you very much for participating in this interview, and I wish you all well.
Thank you so much, Samantha.
Thanks, Samantha.
Thank you.